Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, welcome back. This is Dr. John, and we're back with the latest episode of the Evolved Caveman. And today I got Lawrence Johns on with me, and it's going to be interesting. We're going to talk a little bit about his background, which is fascinating to me, his story of growing up in London. And he's working now with the Mankind Project, UK and I, and doing some fascinating work there. We're also going to talk a little bit about what it's like during the pandemic in London, because I don't know what it's like there. So I'm curious about that as well. So let me give you Lawrence's background real quick. Lawrence is a men's personal development professional, writer, and the training and outreach director of the Mankind Project, UK and I, a charity that supports all men to establish and pursue their life purpose and nurture their emotional well-being. The Mankind Project, UK and I, is part of a global network that has been offering men transformational experiences and supporting them in peer-facilitated men's groups since 1984. Lawrence is the co-founder of Project I Am John, a not-for-profit organization that creates accessible entry points for men to ask the difficult questions about masculinity and provide ongoing support and development at a price point that excludes no one. The project's first feature film is currently in pre-production and is set for release in 2020. He is currently writing his first book on men's personal development. Lawrence works, writes, and skateboards in Southeast London, where he lives with his partner and their son. Lawrence, how you doing? Thanks for coming along.
I'm good. I'm really good. It's good to be here.
Good to see you. So, what's it like in London right now? So it's, what's the date? April 8th?
Yeah.
So we've been in isolation over here for a little over 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think we're in our third week.
Third week, okay.
And in the UK, we sort of done it in our classic way, where no one was quite sure what lockdown meant.
Yeah.
For quite a long time. So some people were out kind of having barbecues in the park and other people were kind of locked at home. But the last couple of weeks, it's kind of really set in, really. And we're pretty much in total lockdown. We're supposed to go out for an hour's exercise a day and for essential shopping and stuff like that. It's a very strange climate. It's a very strange, I mean, London is one of those towns where no one looks at each other anyway. Mm-hmm. And now no one's looking at each other and moving kind of 3 meters away as soon as we spot each other. It's a very, very strange place to be. I'm sure it is all around the world, but it's certainly not the London that I know.
So how are you doing psychologically with this? How are you doing emotionally with this, having been 3 weeks in isolation?
I'm struggling with it, if I'm being honest.
Really? Please.
There's a kind of paradox going on for me, which is in one way I feel very connected to people because we're using stuff like Zoom a lot. You know, within the Mankind Project, we've taken everything online. So there's actually kind of more activity within groups and stuff at the moment. So I'm feeling very connected in that way. But yeah, I'm very aware of lack of physical contact with people. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling the isolation in that way. You know, I'm a very tactile kind of person, and I'm really noticing that. And you know, there's this kind of teenage punk still in me somewhere that just doesn't like the government telling me what to do.
You know, yeah. And I love that part of you.
Thank you very much. But even though it makes perfect sense, there's that angry yob in me that's going, no way, you're gonna go out and go do what, you can't tell me what to do. And if I'm honest, I'm struggling with it.
Yeah.
I'm struggling with it. I don't like not being able to do what I want to do when I want to do it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I felt that frustration. I think there's a lot of people that feel that I don't want to be told what to do, that, you know, rebellious 15-year-old in us, they're kind of like, fuck you, I can do whatever I want. And I think it varies, right? Some people are still compliant. Some people actually won't do what the government's telling them to do, despite the fact that it's in all of our best interests. And I think that it's interesting. You mentioned touch, the lack of touch, and I'm a very, I like to hug and I like to, I get a lot out of the sense of touch. And I know that we live in a touch deprived society prior to this. And there was a study that fascinated me a while back. They looked at how many times a pair of friends touched each other during an hour long cup of coffee. So they would watch two friends meet for a cup of coffee in three different countries, and they tracked the number of touches. Well, in London, it was zero. So you go, you guys have coffee, you're very proper, you don't hug, you don't shake hands, and then you part ways. In the US, it was two. You know, maybe you hug or shake hands at the beginning, hug or shake hands at the end. In Puerto Rico, it was like 127.
Right.
And so it really brings out this stark difference, right, of what, like how touch deprived we are. And this is going to keep it going. This is going to keep it at zero. And I think that's good for us in general. I think we need touch. We need hugs. We know that we get that shot of oxytocin in our brain, that neurotransmitter responsible for trust and rapport and friendship and bonding. I think we're missing that right now.
Yeah. I mean, do you know, was that study for men and women or was it just men or?
I think it was both.
I think it was both. Okay. Because the thing that kind of worries me about that is I think that one of the reasons that we have a tradition of not really touching in the UK was that homosexuality was illegal for so long. You know, still up to like 1968, you could go to prison.
Wow.
So anything that was associated with could be a hint of homosexuality was kind of suppressed and hidden.
Yeah.
But of course, that men paid a big price for that because it made touch dangerous. And so anything that gets in the way of men, I think men really need to be tactile with each other, really need to hug and express.
Well, pardon me for jumping in there, but I've watched I have two sons and I watched them grow up roughhousing. And, you know, it was, you know, one, the younger one would go over to the older one and kind of poke him again, kind of poke the bear. And he would annoy him enough that my older son would get angry at a certain point and jump on him and they start fighting or roughhousing.
Yeah.
And every time my younger son would get hurt, he would end up getting hurt and crying. And I just thought, I started looking at it like, why do they do that? He knows what's going to happen. But, you know, it's a way for him to get attention. It's also a way for both of them to get their need for touch met in a way that's socially acceptable.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, so we males have to go to the extreme because we're socialized so hardly, so harshly to avoid anything that smacks of homosexuality. We can't give each other a hug. We can't give each other, you know, a pat on the back. So instead we have to fight to get our need for touch met.
Yeah, and that really worries me with what's going on in the UK at the moment. I mean, worldwide and the UK at the moment is this whole pandemic really, really buys into a traditional male narrative, you know, if you allow it. Like,
interesting, yeah, you're right.
I can do this on my own, right? Like, I'm going to protect what's mine. If any looting starts and people come around here, like I'm ready for that. I can protect what's mine. I can do it on my own. I don't need anyone else. And we're also topping that up with actual physical isolation. Actually, like you can't meet your friends. You're with your nearest and dearest, but you can't go out to see your friends. You can't get physical touch. That isn't like intimate physical touch if you're living with someone, but you can't get just that sort of camaraderie touch that you need. So it's really like a in many ways, a kind of recipe for disaster for men, you know, and I think we're seeing that, you know, we're seeing a spike in domestic abuse and we're seeing a spike in suicide.
Yeah, it's about 20% on average, the UN chief was saying. And I just did a podcast on that with an anger management expert from New York. And it ranges from about 0% to 70% increase in domestic violence. And they think the counties that are saying 0% are because there's no room to make a call. Because if you're trapped in like an 1,100 square foot, I don't know, condo or apartment, and the abuser's right there on top of you, you can't get out to make a call for help.
No.
I mean, because a lot of times they're with you when you go to the bathroom. Don't close the door. So yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, so it's a very unusual time, you know, like that's the weird thing, like we were saying a little bit before we got on here, you know, there is no there is no template for this. This is unprecedented.
Right.
So everyone is finding their way.
And it's interesting. I appreciate you being honest about how you're feeling, because I'm kind of going recording people's reactions as we get further and further into this, because my hypothesis is that, you know, we get past 3-4 weeks and it's going to get increasingly difficult for us psychologically. And you're going to see more and more people having rage, having panic, having outbursts, physical violence, disobedience. I mean, just in general, I think there's a pretty big percentage of the population, 10, 15, 20%, that is really going to struggle the further we get into isolation.
Yeah.
And we're seeing this in Italy already, where you're starting to see rage and panic break out. And part of it is, I get it. Part of it is, if I don't have any money left to buy food and they're telling me stay inside, there's a breaking point that you reach there. You're like, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
I can't work. I can't make money, but I don't have enough money to buy food. Now what?
Yeah. It has to get real.
Something has to give. Yeah.
Yeah. It has to, you know, it can't go on like that. So it's, yeah. And everyone is finding their way.
You know, it's interesting. I always find that in the darkest times of my life, my work gives me enough meaning to keep me buoyed most of the time. I did get depressed for a couple of days, partly because I'm dealing with spinal stenosis, so I'm in pain all the time. And it ranges from like a 3 to a 10. But part of it was that I got a sty in my eye. So I only have one good eye. And so my good eye swole completely shut. So then I was like, Jesus, like I can't see, I can't stand, I can't walk. Like, who did I kill in a past life to deserve this? And I started to take it personally, right? And I started to feel like, God, you know, man, God just took a big shit on me. But that's part of the depression, right? That you start to take it personally and think it's about you and feel sorry for yourself. So I felt sorry for myself for a couple of days and then got back on the horse.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I started actually, I tend to go the other way. So I make it about other stuff. So, you know, there's like, you know, all the conspiracy theories that are going around. Like every now and again, I find myself thinking like, yeah, that one looks pretty likely, you know?
Yeah.
That's what's going on, right? And then suddenly I'm angry, like I'm being tricked into staying in my house, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just my brain going, trying to scramble on to some bit of meaning. Like, where's the island of reason in all this?
Yeah. Well, I think we go to those dark, pessimistic interpretations and you can start to buy into them. And I think that's the irritability that often is on top of some degree of depression. Yeah. I appreciate you sharing that with me. And part of it is I want to just put out what we're feeling to normalize what other people are feeling, because I don't think there's a normal for this. So almost anything that you're feeling right now is okay. It's like grieving, right? There's no wrong way to grieve. And so if we're all in a state of trauma worldwide, then there's no wrong way to feel right now. It's just a matter of recognizing what you are feeling, putting a label on it, and then kind of breathing through it, allowing it to pass.
And I think that's really important to get out there, you know, because like, if you were to look on, you know, when I'm looking at my Facebook or I'm looking at whatever, you know, like, I'm supposed to be having the time of my life right now. I'm supposed to be like learning how to play the guitar, mastering a second language. You know, I'm supposed to be using this time to get the garden fixed up.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like it's being presented in many ways. Like, hey, this is this opportunity to take this time out. And, okay, it may be that. But also, I'm really afraid of what it's going to look like when I come out on the other side of this.
Right.
You know, what's the economy going to look like? So I'm afraid of that, and so I'm angry because of that, and I've got fear because of that. And some days, the last thing I want to do is kind of get up and do someone's free yoga class or whatever it is. You know? And that's okay. But I think we're being told that we have to be doing all this great stuff now. Seize this opportunity to do all this fantastic stuff. And if you can, like, full credit to you, but don't make it another place where you're going to get your behavior wrong. You know, like,
right. You're absolutely right. Yeah. I was talking to a trauma psychologist, and they were saying they were really getting pretty angry at all these people that were putting out the idea that we were supposed to be super productive right now. Just like you're saying, like learn the guitar, learn a new language, like let's write a book. Because she was saying that we're all in a state of trauma, that our physiological system, our autonomic nervous system is in a state of dysregulation because we're in a completely new and unknown situation. So we're going to have a drop in productivity. And that's okay to give yourself some room to not be hyperproductive, to sit and kind of try and figure this out, to sit and rest, just because these emotions are so damn exhausting. So I think that self-compassion, I think that self-care go to the top of the list right now, that we really have to look at being kind to ourselves.
Yeah, indeed. I couldn't say it better. You know, we have to make it okay to let all this stuff just breathe and feel what we're feeling. Because it's like, you know, we've gone to a classic Western thing of like, hey, guess what? The world is in turmoil. What should we do? Right, do more stuff. That's the answer to this. Do more stuff.
Yeah, do instead of be.
Yeah, rather just spend some time and feel what's going on and work it out for yourself.
When it does make me think about grieving, like I got a client that lost his dad recently, and you know, he's so dysregulated right now. He's so flooded, which he should be. And whenever I get clients in those kind of states, and I think we're all in that state to some degree, that what I look at is go back to the basics. And the basics to me are breathe. Like when I get that dysregulated, I literally have to remind myself to breathe deeply, frequently throughout the day, which I've been doing. And I just keep bringing my attention back to the present moment. Because every time I go out to the future, it's scary and uncertain. So it's, you know, eat 3 meals a day, breathe, get some sort of exercise, get some sleep, take a nap, and be kind to yourself. And so it's really, you know, reminding yourself of stuff you do routinely every day, but you're not doing it because you're so dysregulated.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to get to your story because I loved hearing your story when we first talked. So tell me what it was like growing up in London in your family.
So, yes, I grew up in East London.
That's the good part, right?
That's the good part now. I made it trendy, and now
I know that about you.
Yeah,
you're a trendsetter.
It's fine where I've moved and then move there. So I grew up in a part of East London that was, you know, back in the 80s and early 90s was like the part where no one wanted to go. And that was where I grew up. And I grew up on a housing estate there, which I guess is like what you call a project.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I grew up on a housing estate there, 170 flats, which, you know, had its great side because 170 flats, mainly for one parent families, lots of kids, you know. So
yeah.
it was a real rough and tumble environment, you know. And my dad was a career criminal. So he was in and out of prison, and crime was his way of life. So growing up, really, I grew up in an environment where it was always boom or bust, you know, and that's kind of the ripples that kind of came through my life, really, was the two things that kind of took from growing up was like, life is boom or bust. There was either a load, we either had a lot of money because my dad was out and up to no good, or we had nothing, you know, and there was nothing in between.
Mm.
And when times were good, it was going to be followed by dad being taken away.
Wow.
And so I grew up having a kind of strange relationship with sort of money and things, you know. It was like, it's almost like I didn't want them. Wanted to get rid of everything since I got it, which was very destructive as I got into adult life. And also, like, when you grow up in that sort of environment, when you're a child, when you're out on the street, and that's where you're hanging out, and that's where all your friends are, you're kind of on your own from quite an early age. You know, I remember kind of thinking, very early on, thinking the buck starts with me for how I kind of get on and move in the world. So I kind of got very good at understanding. I think from a very early age, I kind of understood the games that men played very, very early on. because that was the environment, like in my dad's world, like it was all about reputation and power struggle. Like that's it. If you were at the bottom, you were a victim. And if you're at the top, you're safe.
So safety was power.
Safety was power. Safety was power. And you got that by kind of the games that men play, by one-upmanship, by competition, by putting other men down. You know, that's kind of how you protected your position. And then, and that was kind of backed up by the experience I had growing up in that sort of estate environment, in that project environment, because it's very clear there's power there. You know, it's completely misguided, and it's from the outside, it doesn't look like it's there. But what you're doing is you're surviving. Mm-hmm. You're kind of in a constant game for survival, which is based on where you are in the pecking order of, mm-hmm. of that group of people.
What would help you rise up that hierarchy?
So either kind of being good with your fists was one way. Mm-hmm.
Physical violence, yeah.
Physical violence, or being smart.
Yeah. What about things like athleticism or looks, or you know, dating someone that was hot?
Yeah, I mean, all of that. But it was kind of... Did that come into... I guess it did when we got... There was that sort of... We have this thing in London where we have the top boy. That's kind of the term. And if you're a top boy, then that means that you're kind of safe, right? And what that means is, if you sort of, when I start breaking that down, it means that you know how to handle yourself physically, you know how to handle yourself socially, and it means that you understand the games that are played. So when someone on the outside sees what they call banter, or just messing around, joking mm-hmm. around, that isn't men just joking around. That's men creating their structure. It's like, yeah. I get to laugh at you. You don't get to laugh at me. I'm quicker than you. Okay, you might be quick, but I'm stronger than you, so don't push your luck. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that constant playing around. So all the stuff like who you're dating, how you look, all of that it sort of gets you through the door. But it really comes down to how you can handle yourself, either physically or mentally in that position. And as I went through that, as I got older, I realized how exhausting it was, because it was a constant, it felt like a game that was constantly being played.
And how did your dad being in and out of jail affect you socially?
Yeah, it affected me a lot, because he was, when it comes to kind of top boys, he was definitely a top boy.
Okay.
You know? He was good looking. I never saw him out of a suit apart from when he was in prison.
Wow.
He was funny, you know, charming. I mean, when he was in crime, it was fraud, and he's a fraudster. So he was amazingly good at reading people.
Yeah, you said he was a con man, was how you described him earlier to me.
Yeah, so he was amazingly good at reading people. And you know, that comes from his background in that. Yeah.
Well, that would help you climb the hierarchy too.
Yeah. Because it's all about, you know, it's like sales in a way. You're finding out what those people want, and you're finding a way of kind of giving
it. Well, that was a kind of a rule he taught you, right? Find out what people want.
Find out what people want, find out how you can give it to them.
And exploit it.
And then exploit it. And that was one. And his other favorite one was find out where the money is in the room and find out how to get it. So that was very much his sort of view.
There was a couple core beliefs that we talked about when we originally talked that you came out of East London with. And I think it was about people in general and maybe about yourself. Do you remember what those core beliefs were?
So... The core belief, I think, that I left with that I got from my dad was kind of that people are, you're either predator or prey.
Okay.
That was kind of the main kind of, if I boil it all down, it really came down to that.
So you're either being used or you're the user.
Being used to being used, and yeah, that was completely his view of the world.
And if you were being used, you're a sucker.
You're a sucker.
Yeah.
And then you deserve it.
Yeah.
Because you're a sucker, right? You know, that's just how it is. So I kind of had all this stuff going on, really. You know, by the time I'd grown into a young man, I was kind of really good at reading people. I had a kind of weird relationship with money.
Similar to what happened with your dad when you were growing up. So you'd get some, lose it, get some, lose it.
Get some, lose it. It was almost like I had times when I was very successful and kind of, it was almost like I would press the self-destruct button straight away.
So you were just recreating the pattern you had grown up in.
Yeah. And when I'd done work on it later on, what I realized was whenever I had enough, whenever there was abundance, psychologically, it meant a loss was coming. Something bad was going to happen.
Yeah.
That's what always happened. We had a great Christmas. We had loads of stuff. And then guess what? January, Dad goes away. You know, so it was like, I had that going on. And then I had this kind of, the world had been presented to me as a game that had to be played. And you were either kind of like a winner or a loser in it. And that was kind of how I judged people in many ways. As like, he's like me, he ain't, right? And so it was a kind of, you know, and there was a really brilliant side to it too. You know, my dad was like, when he was around, an amazingly attentive, intelligent man, and kind of because of his weird view, would go like, you're not going to school today. I'm going to take you to an art gallery instead. You know, so I left with this kind of understanding of culture. I left with a sort of, one of his other sayings was, the only way you could disappoint me is if you were ordinary. So I kind of had this view of like, okay, it's okay to be different. It's okay to do other stuff.
Yeah, I like that one.
That was a good one.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, this exhausting game that I was aware was being played, where someone was either trying to beat you all the time.
Yeah.
It wasn't as a young man, I never had a conversation where I wasn't aware of a power dynamic going on.
Well, and I love that idea of masculinity being hard won and easily lost.
Yeah.
Like you have to work, scratch, claw to get up that hierarchy, and then you can lose it like that. You know, if you do the wrong thing, say the wrong thing, cry in public, you know, whatever it is,
and
it can be gone in a second.
Yeah. It's subtle stuff, you know. It's like letting someone make one joke too many at your expense,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly that's it. You're down a couple of runs on the ladder.
So what happens then later when you become an adolescent, a teenager? I thought there was an angry piece to the story that you rebelled a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, like, I can't, yeah. So I got thrown out of school. Then I kind of just sort of hung out for a while. I've just kind of done the street thing for a while and just kind of hung out eventually went back into education, but by then, like, I just kind of got into music, and it was like drink and drugs and partying. You know, it was the early 90s in London. It was the time of Blur and Oasis. It was kicking off, and I fully went into that.
Okay, so just quickly out of curiosity, what music were you into growing up? Because I see you as a Clash kind of a guy.
Well, I was mainly into hip hop.
Really?
Hip hop. Yeah, I was a hip hop bod. And I was into all of that because that's kind of what we were into. But then when I got to about 18, I got into skateboarding, and then that kind of turned things around. Once I was into skateboarding, it changed. And then suddenly it was like punk and rock music. And that was a pivotal moment, really, because skateboarding was what took me away from the estate.
And you got pretty good at skateboarding.
Yeah, I was good. I was good. And it, I mean, it was a very different kind of business to what it is now. So you could never really do that well, but I was good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't do that for too long.
And so how bad did things get for you at the lowest in your life?
So there's kind of been a couple of low points for me, really. I think, like, there was a low point before I sort of turned things around and got back into education and got an idea of where I wanted to go, wanted to do. And so things started getting better. And I went back to college and it was like straight A's. And then I kind of, by luck, I got involved in the rare book industry and was a director of a company by the time I was like 24. We were the biggest book dealership in the UK at the time. But it was kind of a false, it was kind of like a false, not a false success, but it was like a false peak. I wasn't up that mountain yet, you know? And then because I really sort of in a way wasn't being true to myself, the kind of the drink got heavy, you know, it got really, really heavy. And
yeah.
And then 2008 come and everything that I'd kind of built up kind of got tore apart again. And it was sort of bailiff at the house kind of time and all of that. And that was when I think I really hit my lowest point at that time.
So when you say bailiff for the house,
yeah,
that means
it was like bailiff for the house is like the debt collectors or whatever.
Okay, gotcha.
Or whatever you call them, receivers, I think.
Gotcha.
At the door. You know, and I had a son who was not even a year old at that time. And I was just drunk out of my mind most of the time. You know, not at home. And I remember one morning just kind of, I literally had like 50 quid left in my pocket or something, you know, and I kind of thought like, this is like literally the end. You know, this is kind of, I don't know how I'm going to get out of this. And kind of went home and just went through a period of sort of almost lying to myself, like the classic stuff of like waiting for my wife to leave so I could go back to bed because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how I was going to get out of this. It was like the phone was, every phone call was someone after something, you know, and it was just, you know, luckily I'd done my Mankind Project thing a few years before that. So I had a group of men who weren't buying any of it. They weren't buying that I was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kind of kept showing up, even though I was going, like, trying to hide from them too. But they kind of kept showing up. And really, like, it's one of those classic things. As I look at that time now, really, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I got my values right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember that day coming home and looking at my son, and I'd been out all night and I'd almost spent the last of the money looking down at my son and just thinking like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? All you've got to do is show up for that little boy. You know, that's all you've got to do right now. Like, that's it. He's not even a year old. And that set around kind of a real period of change. I threw myself back into the Mankind Project fully. I started getting fit. You know, I got my skateboard again, started doing that, you know, which was hard because I was rubbish at it. but, you know, it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
So how does the Mankind Project enter into all this? Because that organization seemed to have played a big role in you rebounding.
Yeah, and a couple of times. I mean, the other time it was all going kind of a bit weird for me was before I'd done my New Warrior Training Adventure, which is the main weekend. And I was working for a bookseller at the time. And like he just came in to the office one morning, and I was, you know, completely up to no good. I'd been up all night, and I was finishing off the remnants of what I had in my pocket off his desk. And
you got caught doing cocaine off his desk, right?
His desk. Yeah. And where I was lucky was I didn't realize that this guy was an MKP man. You know, I didn't know that. I'd seen that he had a bunch of huggy friends, but like, I didn't know he was an MKP man. And so he kind of got me to one side and said, listen, but I thought it was the talk. Like, I thought, like, you're fired, you know. Mm-hmm. Here's what we're going to do. He said, I've got this weekend. I think it's exactly what you need. He said, I'm going to pay it for you to go. He said, if you go and you just come back and you say, it's not for me, a load of rubbish, it's not for me. I'll just swallow the money. You don't have to pay me back. He said, but you've got to look me in the eye. Look me in the eye and say it didn't work. He said, and if it works, then it'll work out a way you can just pay me back at your wages. So I was like, right, I've got nothing to lose. And like the manipulative part of me was like, you know what? And this looks a bit like looks a bit cultish. Maybe like being in a cult with my boss might be a good idea. You know, that was all the stuff that was going in my head. That would be a good idea. So I'll go off and do this weekend. And yeah, I mean, I went on that weekend, and everyone who does that weekend gets something different out of it. If you talk to them, say, yeah, I got this, I got that, you know, I resolved this issue, whatever it was. But for me, what I got, it wasn't like I learned anything massively new about myself. But when I looked around, I saw that game that I'd learned about one-upmanship amongst men had been turned on its head. And what I saw was, actually, the more these men are vulnerable, the stronger they seem, and the more respect they seem to be getting for the more they show of themselves. And even the stuff that I thought was ugly, even the stuff that I wouldn't want to share to anyone, I realized I could share it. Not only would it be like, okay, they would respect me for sharing it.
Mm-hmm.
We were all the same. So I learned this, I literally looked around the room at this one point and thought, this is a different way of being. I've learned a different way of being a man. And it was a collaborative way. And it was where a place where it wasn't me against everyone else. It was kind of, we're all in this together.
And I think if I can jump in there, I think that's the essential paradox of vulnerability. Like, I've gone through this trauma, this struggle, which we're all going through right now in this pandemic, but I've gone through this trauma and I've shared some of my internal world. So I'm more vulnerable and more open. And yet simultaneously, I'm also stronger and more resilient. So it's like, I'm more vulnerable and yet I'm stronger. It's this odd paradox.
Yeah.
But I think you're absolutely right. I love what you're saying.
Yeah,
I think that's the key takeaway here.
It really is. I mean, it's like as I continue my journey through kind of men's personal development, I continually learn it's full of paradoxes. It's almost always a paradox, you know, and it's like the more vulnerable I am, the stronger I get.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point too. I mean, there's a line by Chris Christopherson. He said, you know, he's a walking contradiction. And I think that's true for humans in general, that there are these paradoxes, there are these contradictions, and the awareness that we're big enough to contain them, that we're big enough to like feel multiple things about the same thing simultaneously. Or, I mean, one of the things I think of is there's that rational intellectual side of me that knows there's no empirical proof for the existence of God. So therefore God's not real. And then the emotional side of me says, well, yeah, but I find it comforting to believe in a higher power. I'm going to choose to believe in a higher power. So there's, there's both within me.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important thing for us to, it's brought me so much peace to kind of to recognize a duality in myself often. You know, like even like everything we're talking about in terms of like men's personal development, I've got to be at a stage where, sure, I want to change stuff and there's bits in my life I want to improve. And I've got to love myself absolutely as I am right now. And if I never change another bit, that's okay.
Well put.
You know, and it's constantly those paradoxes, you know, and I saw all of that within the Mankind Project. You know, I found a place where I could be that paradox. I could show up great one day and then, you know, confused the next day. And that's all right.
Yeah.
As long as I'm showing up, it's all right.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the longer I kind of work on the mind, the more I realize that the mind is basically this bubbling cauldron of ideas, thoughts, emotions, sensations, urges, and they're all kind of fighting for attention. They're all fighting for that dominance. And the prefrontal cortex at the last second goes, I'll choose you. And that's what you say, or that's what you do. And so we aren't really always internally consistent. I think we strive to be, but we do have those conflicting forces within us. We do have those paradoxes within us.
Yeah.
So tell me, we only got about 5 minutes left. Tell me about your new project. Yeah, it goes fast, huh?
Yeah.
Tell me about the project that you're working on with MKP right now, because that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And this pandemic has kind of changed it yet again on a kind of...
For everyone, yeah.
And so what we were doing is we were much more moving... MKP, we always had one way in. It was like you've done the NWTA, the New Warrior...
And spell that out for people because they don't know the acronym.
Yeah, so that's the New Warrior Training Adventure. That's a three-day experiential weekend, like what I was just talking about that I'd done. And then from that, you'd go and you'd join one of our peer-facilitated men's groups. And you'd continue to kind of grow and work in that way. What we're doing now is much more outwardly focused. So we're creating more men's groups so that men can find a way into the work before. And it's not necessarily to try and kind of feed the program. It's just that we want more men in more circles from more communities, feeling the benefit and the power of men's groups. And literally, like over the last 2 weeks, we've just really ramped it up online. We've had to take it online. And so we're starting 50 new connection circles in England in the next 12 weeks.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah.
That's huge.
And so, yeah, so that's what we're doing. You know, we work by connecting men to life purpose and nurturing their emotional well-being. And these groups that we set up do that. You know,
well, and it's fascinating to me because I've spoken with several MKP people on this podcast, and the emotional literacy that they show is always astounding. Like I just spoke with Ray Arata, who's done like over 50 of those. He's led 50 of those New Warrior Adventures weekends. And it's so refreshing to talk to a man that has some awareness of his internal landscape, specifically his emotional landscape.
Yeah. And that's why, like, you know, like my weekend was great, right? There was nothing like it. It was like a life changing event for me. I feel the most development came from me from being in men's group since 2002, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Jed Diamond has been, he's like a legend in this men's work area. I think he's written 16 or 17 books, and his newest book is 12 Rules for Good Men. And his first rule is join a men's group.
Yeah.
And it does change everything. I mean, it changes the way you see other men.
Yeah. And I think the reason is because on many levels, I believe we're still a pack animal. Mm-hmm. I believe that men are still
absolutely
pack animals.
Yeah.
And we look around the world and we see that if you get men in groups, you know, they're really capable of doing terrible things. And that's by increment, you know, like that little comment that you let slide about the girl who works in your office with the other guy soon turns into like,
yes, someone's
watched her, right? It's like we give ourselves permission to misbehave. And if you're in a men's group, you're turning that model on its head. You've got a group of men who are encouraging you to be more emotionally authentic. They're encouraging you to show up in your life with accountability and integrity, and who are expecting more from you, are expecting you to hold yourself to a higher regard, not in terms of like going out and, you know, becoming a millionaire CEO or any of that stuff, but just showing up as you want to show up in your life and doing what's important to you. And what we do is we just take that pack mentality and it becomes a healthy culture of, by increment, we encourage each other to be a little bit more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. We encourage each other to show up, encourage each other to ask for what we want more, to express ourselves clearer. And so I would 100% agree that rule number one is getting a men's group. He's on the money, for sure.
Okay, so is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have?
I don't think so.
Okay.
It feels like we sort of covered everything.
Yeah, and I appreciate you sharing your story. I think the story is fascinating. And it's always beautiful to me to see the depths in someone's life and then see them overcome the depths to get to that height where they are now. Like, that story arc is just it doesn't get any better in my mind. So where can people get a hold of you if they would like to find out more information?
So I'm across all social media as Lawrence H. Johns.
Okay. And Lawrence is L-A-U-R-E-N-C-E.
That's right. Okay. And our UK Mankind Project website is themankindprojectuki.org.
Awesome. And those will be in the show notes as well.
Great.
So Lawrence, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciated this. I really enjoy talking to you. I love the story, as I said.
Thank you. It's great to be on. I really enjoyed it. It went so fast.
It does.
4 hours.
All right. And that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Please be sure to rate, share, and review so we can get the message out to more men. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.